Hello and welcome to Science World. We'll begin our program today with an update report on the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. A British and Italian research team has painted a scary future for our universe in a study that was published this past week. Science World's Doug Bernard will have the story. Jessica Berman will tell us about new research that has resulted in a promising new vaccine in preventing hepatitis C, a disease that can lead to early death from liver cancer and scarring. And the European Space Agency's comet-chasing Rosetta mission plans to send its lander called Philae down to the surface of Comet 67P on Wednesday, November 12th. If they're successful, it will be the first time that any man-made object would make a soft touchdown on a comet. Mark McCorkran, the European Space Agency's senior scientific advisor for space science missions, will join us for today's one-on-one segment to preview the Philae landing and update us on the Rosetta mission itself. We'll have these stories and more on today's edition of VOA Science, Health, and Technology Magazine, Science World. International health officials say the number of new Ebola cases in West Africa is declining. Despite the improvement, the United Nations is calling for more international help to fight the deadly virus. Zlatisa Hoek has this report.
The good news from West Africa began trickling in last week. The Ebola coordinator at the Guinean Health Ministry said Tuesday in Paris that the numbers of new cases are declining in Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea.
The figures are declining because the number of confirmed cases that we had in healthcare centers, the number also of suspected cases that we had in healthcare centers, these figures are starting to decline. Not in a very significant way, but we realize that these figures are decreasing.
In Liberia's capital, Monrovia, a United Nations official in charge of emergency Ebola response confirmed there has been a significant improvement in the fight against the deadly disease. Fewer people are getting infected and fewer are dying from it. But the battle against Ebola is far from over, warns the UN official Anthony Bembury.
We need NGOs and others to come in and run these facilities. We're putting in place the logistics capabilities. We're building the care centers. We're getting the equipment, everything we need to go in them. The patients are there in far too great numbers. What we don't have are the partners to run the facilities, and we need them now.
U.S. health authorities have expressed hope that a new vaccine will bring an end to the outbreak that has killed about 5,000 people and infected close to 14,000. Lausanne's University Hospital in Switzerland began testing the vaccine Tuesday on healthy volunteers.
I think the sooner we have a vaccine that works, that is safe, then the sooner we can use that vaccine to vaccinate the people in West Africa and wherever else the Ebola could spread.
Experts say there is no danger of contracting Ebola from the vaccine.
What we measure is antibodies to the protein which is produced by the vaccine. And we also do some specific and detailed analysis on the white blood cells in the blood to ask the question whether the cells exposed to the vaccine have a different biology than those who have not been exposed to the vaccine.
If the testing proves effective, it will be done on a larger trial basis. French researchers are in the pre-production phases of an Ebola test that would give results in 15 minutes compared to about 24 hours it takes the current tests. Faster tests also are being developed in the United States and Japan. Zlatica Hoek, VOA News, Washington.
This past week, a team of British and Italian scientists published a new study that suggests an ominous future for the universe. Science World's Doug Bernard tells us more.
The team of researchers from the UK's University of Portsmouth and the Sapienza University of Rome reviewed new astronomical data. What they found is that the amount of dark energy seems to be increasing as it feeds off of dark matter. Now, for the record, dark energy is a theoretical form of energy that cosmologists believe is responsible for the accelerating expansion of the universe. Dark matter is a hypothetical form of matter that is invisible to electromagnetic radiation. This increase in dark energy at the expense of dark matter, according to the researchers, appears to be slowing the growth of cosmic structures, such as galaxies and galaxy clusters in the universe. Professor David Wands, head of the University of Portsmouth's Institute of Cosmology and Gravitation, and a member of the research team, said that if dark energy is growing while dark matter is disappearing, we could end up with a big, empty, boring universe with almost nothing in it. To reach their findings, the team studied and analyzed the data from a number of astronomical surveys, which included the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. With these extensive data sets, they were able to study the growth of cosmological structures and test various models of dark energy that have been developed. Back in 2011, U.S. scientists Saul Perlmutter and Adam Rice, along with Brian Schmidt of Australia, shared the Nobel Prize in Physics for finding evidence that the universe is not only expanding, but is doing so at an increasingly accelerated speed. Scientists have said that the findings made by the Nobel laureate have shaken the study of cosmology to its core. David Wands said there has been increasing proof that the simple models provided by the research of the 1990s can't explain many things that scientists are now finding in fresher and more extensive astronomical data that's being made available. For Science World, I'm Doug Bernard.
A United Nations panel on climate change says global warming is causing extreme weather all over the world and is calling on governments to come up with new ideas to curb gas emissions. Since much of the air pollution comes from coal-fired power plants, scientists in Denmark are trying to lower their nation's energy needs with new types of smart streetlights. Science World's Bob Doty has this report by George Butich.
Our increasingly industrialized world needs huge amounts of electrical energy, but our power plants still rely mostly on technology introduced as early as the 19th century. Coal-powered plants, hydroelectric dams, or somewhat newer nuclear energy, all of which have their own shortcomings. Renewable sources, such as solar plants and wind turbines, have just started making inroads to lowering harmful emissions, while safer fusion-based nuclear plants are believed to be many decades off. But scientists say we can slow down global warming by lowering energy demands for streetlights. These common features of the world's urban areas require a lot of electricity. The U.S. Energy Information Administration estimates that in 2012, lighting for buildings, streets, and highways in the United States used about 274 billion kilowatt hours. In a bid to make Copenhagen the world's first carbon-neutral city by 2025, scientists in the Danish capital are testing a variety of new street lighting technologies. Kim Brostrom is the chief technical officer at the Danish Outdoor Lighting Lab.
We have installed 9 kilometers of streets. We have 280 masts placed here. We have 50 different solutions. We have 10 different management systems. And we have a lot of different sensors and things out in the open area.
Chief Science Officer Jacob Anderson says the lights can be managed individually from a tablet computer or a smartphone.
You can monitor the runtime, efficacy, the lumen output, or the power consumption. And then we do real-time measurements on the lux levels on the street level.
The main goal is to lower energy consumption when the light is not needed. So the lamp brightens up only when it senses an approaching pedestrian, cyclist, or vehicle. Some of them even have a backup wind generator or a solar cell. Scientists say installing the smart lights citywide could save up to 85% of the current budget for illuminating the Copenhagen streets. For Science World, I'm Bob Doty.
Coming up in a few minutes, we'll get a preview of the upcoming trip to the surface of Comet 67P by the European Space Agency's Philae lander. We'll also get an update of the comet-chasing Rosetta mission. So, for today's Science World Quick Quiz, we have a question about a comet. Back in July of 1994, the Hubble Space Telescope gave us a front row seat to a rare astronomical event of a comet smashing into the planet Jupiter. What we'd like to know is, what was the name of that comet? Was it A, Comet Hale-Bopp, B, Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9, or C, Comet Sighting Spring? Think about it, and good luck. We'll give you the correct answer in just a few minutes from now.
You're listening to Science World, VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine.
Experts say an estimated 118 million people around the world are infected with hepatitis C, which can lead to early death from liver cancer and scarring. Now, researchers are testing a vaccine that shows great promise in preventing the disease. Jessica Berman reports.
A cure for viral hepatitis C was announced recently with great fanfare. An illness that was previously resistant to the best treatments was suddenly vanquished. But medication to fight the liver disease comes with a hefty price tag. The cost of a course of drugs to cure hepatitis C infection is around $80,000, a price most people cannot afford. Another major development is on the horizon, a vaccine that protects against hepatitis C infection. The drug combines an inactive chimpanzee cold virus and a hepatitis protein. It stimulates the production of thousands of key immune system cells to guard against infection with the virus. Eleanor Barnes is a scientist with Oxford University's medical school in Britain. She says the expensive new drugs may cure hepatitis C, but they don't prevent reinfection with a different strain.
In contrast, a vaccine, if it's effective and it's a good vaccine, can protect patients with one or two injections for the rest of their life. So vaccines really have proved themselves historically to be the very best medicine.
Barnes made her comments in an interview with Science Translational Medicine. This week's edition of the journal includes an article on her work with an international team to develop a hepatitis C vaccine. Different versions of hepatitis C are common in different parts of the world. Barnes says there's evidence that the experimental vaccine may protect against more than one strain of the virus. Vaccines are usually designed to marshal a targeted antibody response to an infection. Antibodies are the immune system's first-line soldiers to recognize a microbial invader and stimulate a broader attack. What's different about her team's vaccine, Barnes says, is that it stimulates a robust T-cell response. T-cells are other weapons in the body's immune system. These fighter cells target multiple parts of the virus. Like HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, the hepatitis C virus mutates quickly, hampering vaccine development. And Barnes says hepatitis C patients, like those infected with HIV, often go to the doctor at a late stage of infection when they start to feel sick.
Many patients will present for the first time to a healthcare physician when their disease is very advanced, because the disease is a silent one. Until you get advanced liver disease associated with fibrosis and liver cancer.
So far, the vaccine has undergone early clinical trials, which showed it's safe in people. The research paves the way for more advanced clinical trials in the United States among uninfected intravenous drug users who are at highest risk of contracting the virus. The vaccine causes short-term side effects, including fatigue and migraine headaches. Hepatitis C can also be spread by blood transfusions, sharing razors or toothbrushes with someone who has the disease, or through sexual contact. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
One of the many adverse effects of global climate change is the rise of sea levels, which scientists say can increase the salinity level of freshwater reserves. As salt water cannot be used for irrigation, farm fields close to the seashore are lost to agriculture. But a farm in the Netherlands has managed to grow healthy and tasty vegetables in soil irrigated with salt water. George Putich reports.
Salinization is reducing the world's irrigated lands by 1 to 2% annually, according to the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization. But that doesn't faze Dutch farmer Mark van Reisenberg, who has used saline water to kill some plants in order to identify which ones are able to thrive.
We put in a lot of plants in the field, and then we put them in fresh water and in seawater and all the varieties between it. And then we see which variety is surviving and which variety is dying.
Working with scientists from the Free University of Amsterdam, van Reisenberg and his team divided a farm into 8 plots covered with a network of irrigation pipes. Separate pipes bring fresh and seawater to a distribution center, where a computer-controlled system mixes irrigation water with 8 different degrees of salinity.
And then the computer says go, and then it goes to the fields and the dripping irrigation starts to work, and we're going to kill plants. That's it.
Numerous sensors continuously control soil salinity and moisture. Van Reisenberg says they were able to harvest vegetables from most of the test plots. Although they were smaller than normal, he says they contain more sugar and salt, so they taste better.
It's a miracle. I mean, it shouldn't be a carrot. It should be dying. If we look at the data that are available in the world at the moment.
The farm managed to grow carrots, cabbage, onions and beetroot, but potatoes proved to be the most tolerant to saline water. Van Reisenberg says 4 varieties of salt-tolerant potatoes were recently shipped to Pakistan, where thousands of hectares of land damaged by salinization are being prepared for testing the Dutch potatoes. George Putic, VOA News, Washington.
Let's see if you have the correct answer to this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We wanted to know the name of the comet that smashed into Jupiter back in the summer of 1994. Was it A, Comet Hale-Bopp, B, Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9, or C, Comet Sighting Spring? The answer is B. Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 was discovered by husband and wife astronomers Eugene and Carolyn Shoemaker and David Levy in March of 1993. The comet had shattered into about 12 fragments. Scientists think that the gravity of Jupiter caused it to break apart. The comet fragments crashed into the giant planet from July 16th through the 22nd, 1994. With the Hubble Spacecraft Telescope capturing images of this historic series of impacts, we were all treated to a spectacular view of what is considered by many as the first direct observation of a deep space object colliding with a member of our solar system family. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
This is Science World on VOA. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science.
There's an unmistakable buzz of anticipation among the members of the European Space Agency's comet-chasing Rosetta mission. That's because if all goes according to plan, its Philae lander will be sent down to the surface of Comet 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko on November 12th, making it the first spacecraft to ever touch down softly on the nucleus of a comet. After hitching a 10-year ride aboard the Rosetta, the Philae will be gently released by its mothership and dropped down to a landing location that was carefully selected by mission scientists and engineers. Mark McCorkran, the European Space Agency's Senior Scientific Advisor for Space Science Missions, joins us once again to preview the upcoming Philae landing and update us on the Rosetta mission itself. Things with the Rosetta mission have been quite busy.
They've been enormously busy, and they're really ramping up now, very, very intense. And this is really something that nobody's ever done before, which is to arrive at a new world with no idea what it looks like and have to prepare to land on it just a few months later. I mean, normally you would have years of studies, and you'd look at data from previous missions. With Rosetta and with Philae, we just got there in August, and we're landing in November. So it's been incredibly intense getting ready for this.
I understand that the location where the Philae is supposed to land was initially called Site J, but now has an actual name. Can you tell us about this and how the name was selected?
We ran a competition. Anybody could enter the competition, and people were asked to suggest names, but also to send in a bit of text, you know, a few words to explain why they chose the name. And the winner was chosen by a committee, and it turned out to be one of the most popular names that was submitted. And it's the name Agilkia, although my Greek is not so great. And Agilkia is interesting. It has a direct relationship to Philae, which is the name of our lander, of course. Philae is an island in the Nile where there are a number of ancient Egyptian temples. Those were actually flooded in the 20th century when the Aswan dams were built for irrigation and flood control in Egypt. And so the temples were actually picked up and moved slightly uphill to a new island, and that's the name of the island, Agilkia. And so it was in many ways appropriate. It's about, if you like, exploring a new world, the Philae as well.
Can you give us a little bit of a timeline of events that will take place between the Rosetta and Philae on November 12th?
Things actually start on November the 11th in many ways. Late evening here, nighttime in Europe. We have a whole series of go, no-go, as we call them, events, you know, points of what decisions have to be made. Are we on the right orbit, the right trajectory? Do we have the commands ready to upload to the spacecraft? Have they been uploaded? Is the lander ready for separation? So there's a whole bunch of points which occur during the night through to the morning of November the 12th. But then separation is due to occur at 9:35 in the morning, Central European time, at the spacecraft. We're so far away from the spacecraft, it takes about 30 minutes for the signal to arrive at Earth. So we'll know that separation occurred at around 4 minutes past 10 in the morning, European time. Then there's a whole range of things that have to happen. Rosetta actually maneuvers away. It leaves Philae on its trajectory towards the comet, but then Rosetta, if you like, flies up and goes on to a new trajectory, so it can maintain a view of Philae all the time, so radio signals can be transmitted. And what that means is about a two-hour delay between us, the deployment. We hear about it, but then after that, we don't establish contact with Philae again for another 2 hours. Then around lunchtime here, we start getting a few images in, which have been taken during the descent, seeing the comet approaching. And what we are looking to, the timescale we're looking at for landing is somewhere in the window between 4:30 in the afternoon, European time, and 5:30. And the reason there's a window there is that we're not actually actively driving down to the surface with rockets or anything else, and there are uncertainties in the process. We're just falling. And because this comet's a crazy object, there are uncertainties in everything we're doing. So somewhere in that window, we expect to land and get confirmation of landing. Roughly 2 hours later, we'll get the first images back from the surface. So it's going to be a really exciting time that afternoon.
How soon after touchdown will specific science data come into the headquarters?
The data will flow back immediately. Actually, we'll be taking data as we go down towards the surface because some of the instruments will be on and they'll be measuring the environment of the comet, the material flowing away from it. And those data we'll capture back on the Earth even before landing. But once we get to the surface, we have just less than 64 hours of battery lifetime. We have a big primary battery on board, and that will power what we call the initial surface science, so the stuff, the first measurements we make. And all of that has to come back in those first 64 hours because that's the initial goal for the mission. We can then recharge a secondary battery using solar cells on the lander, and the mission could go on as long as March on the surface, at which point in March we're getting a bit too close to the sun and the lander will heat up. It probably won't work anymore. But we'll be getting the data back within the first few hours. Analyzing them and understanding them, that's another thing entirely. It's a really big thing for us, incredibly ambitious, you know, really, really audacious to do it. And, you know, the landing is not the whole mission. Rosetta is a success already. Nobody's ever done this before. Nobody's got close to a comet. Nobody's rendezvoused with one the way we have and is orbiting one. So we've already got huge amounts of science data that people are working on really hard. And after landing, we stay there. And in fact, for many people, the most exciting phase is next year when the comet gets it to its closest point to the sun in August next year. It'll light up. We're going to see the tail grow. We're going to see stuff moving around on the surface. So Philae next week is a fantastic thing, but it's just a piece of the mission. The mission is a success and will be one. Never mind what happens next week. We've got our fingers crossed, but the whole mission doesn't ride on it.
That was Mark McCorkran, Senior Scientific Advisor for Space Science Missions at the European Space Agency, which is headquartered in Paris. That's it for this edition of Science World. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I am Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.